Hello, this is Matt Hale bringing you the Art Monthly talk show on Resonance 104.4 FM. And we are graced with the boss presence of Ed from Resonance. Thanks, Ed, for doing the engineering for me. I still haven't learned how to do it properly, although I've been doing many programmes and it's time I did. And I'm joined today by three guests for the Art Monthly talk show. But before I go any further, just very briefly, the show is based primarily on texts in the magazine, and the magazine is, in this case, April 2017, number 405. And we have conversations about what the writers have written about, he said ineptly. Basically, this time, it's with Paul O'Kane, who's done a book review, Bryony White, who's written a letter from Istanbul, and Jamie Sutcliffe, who has reviewed Independent Frame's American Experimental Animation, 1970s-1980, which was at Tate Modern. So sort of one is an event that occurred of animation films. One is a visit to Istanbul, but primarily it talks, don't you, Bryony, I think about performance, at an artist performance. And then we have a book review by Paul. And we're going to try and tie them all together. We don't always manage to do it absolutely seamlessly, but I think it's always interesting to try. We'll start off, I think, talking about the performance and the visit to Istanbul by Bryony. Bryony's not been on before, so thanks for coming on the show, Bryony. Hello.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Basically, we have a section at the back of the magazine called Letter From, and so you go there. But the reason you went, I guess, may be because of your interest in performance. You're doing PhD, as I call them, PhD. which I think involves performance. Tell me briefly what, obviously you can't tell me all, you haven't finished it anyway, have you?
So I'm looking at the relationship between performance, contemporary art and the law. So I'm specifically looking at histories of intellectual property law as they kind of arise in the last 40 years of performance art history, basically.
And then this interest you spotted in Istanbul that there was particular events going on which were all about performance. And obviously Istanbul was a very particular place and lots going on all the time. I mean, without sort of trying to sum up your whole piece very quickly, I mean, I noticed particularly that you mentioned performances politically quite... artist performance being quite a politically strong form. If you're going to deal with politics in art...
Yeah.
In Istanbul, it seems currently that performance is the way to do it.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's because of performance. It has had a very kind of sort of considerably radical history. It's been considered quite anti-institutional in many ways. So it's almost that it's...
Historically?
Yeah, historically.
Not just there, but just
everywhere, really, because it came out against the market. It came out against kind of commercial galleries. So in many ways, it's kind of quite an eruptive force, I think, quite discursive. I think it fights against sort of what the institution can try and sort of do to the form in a way. But specifically, I was invited to Istanbul in particular by a platform called Perform Istanbul, which is run by Simge Berhangola, who basically... is working to ensure kind of greater awareness of performance art in Turkey and in Istanbul in general, to sort of give performance artists a platform, because performance art has a very different set of rules and regulations than I think it does maybe in the UK or in North America. It doesn't have as much visibility within institutions or within the kind of like visual arts history.
So I looked at the website actually, and it looks almost like a museum website.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have a venue, does it? Or does it?
No, it's very nomadic. It's more of a platform. It's kind of like a collective in many ways. It's kind of bringing together artists that are working with performance, and then they're kind of approaching institutions and sort of trying to arrange sort of events together and that kind of thing. But I think it's what's so great about it is it's a very sort of sustainable model. It's about ensuring that performance artists are getting paid, and they're getting the sort of the rewards that they should be getting for making work, which I think actually performance artists in general aren't sometimes remunerated properly, as you would be if you were kind of working with painting or sculpture, for example. I mean, that's quite a broad claim, but I do think there's something about performance art where people think that they don't necessarily have to treat it like they would do other mediums or other artists.
Yeah, because you mentioned briefly outside about your PhD, you know, how documentation of performance is what might be sold after the event, obviously. And I've been to a few shows where there's stuff on the floor.
Yeah.
Like detritus, as it were, post-performance detritus, detritus or whatever. And then that's recorded or some of the bits are kept. And obviously that is how it gets commodified. But but going into the political side of it, because I'm interested in that, because in Paul's piece, to tie them together a bit, with Paul's piece, you know, we're talking about video installation. We'll come to that more, but it's like how, I'm really interested to know how you feel they may be effective politically in Istanbul, which is a very difficult place to be effective in any way.
100%, especially in Turkey. There's no, unlike the UK, there's no kind of public funding. There's no state funding for the arts in general. So a lot of the money that's going into galleries and sort of big institutions is from private funding. So that operates very differently to how it does here. And I don't want to just draw a straight comparison between the UK and Turkey because that would be easy. But I mean, that's kind of what I'm going off because it's what I know. But I think also because of that, its performance works really interestingly in Turkey because it means that they kind of operate in a slightly different way in the sense that they might use public space slightly more than they would do institutional space. And there's a really interesting kind of, I think one of the reasons that it's quite effective is because there's quite an interesting blurring between kind of private and public spheres and how those are used and how and what they mean kind of politically. So, for example, you know, you had like Standing Man in Gezi Park during the protests there where this man sort of stood for a while and then it became this kind of ongoing kind of political protest. So there's some really interesting blurring of the lines between performance and protest in Turkey as well, which I think is quite interesting and is part of kind of its efficacy, I think, as a medium.
You mentioned at one point about a person who was doing a performance, I'm not sure where it was, but he was holding a stone.
Yes, yeah. So that is Ay Ata Doğul, and he is a Turkish artist, and he did a performance at the Zilberman Gallery, which was 48 hours long, and it was the longest durational performance ever done in Turkey, and it was 48 hours, and he was in the gallery basically kind of sleeping and eating, but he had his eyes covered and noise-cancelling headphones on for the duration of the performance. And, I mean, it was a really kind of effective experience and one that I think I'm still kind of grappling with and think about quite a lot. But it was a very vulnerable performance. You know, he was there in the space and he couldn't see anything, he couldn't hear anything. And I think, you know, it was obviously working on the sort of machinations of trust and vulnerability, which I think are very much up in the air in the sort of political climate in Turkey in the moment, especially kind of this like singular individual body versus like the body politic almost.
Yeah, because a woman he drops the stone, and she put it back and bent down and picked it up for him.
Yeah.
And that close, I mean, involving the audience as a thing and obviously very sensitive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Paul or Jamie, do you have any particular questions? Don't worry if you don't.
Yes. No, I do actually.
Please do.
Just in relation to censorship and the witch hunt that seemed to kind of unfold over the course of the last year in Turkey. I know that the Kanakal Biennale was kind of cancelled, and in the wake of that, there were a series of investigations into supposedly insurrectionary artistic practice. Mm. And I just wondered, you touched briefly on censorship, but I just wondered what kind of resonance these performances had and whether or not there were kind of clandestine sort of languages at play within performance that were maybe not kind of picked up on, or I just wonder how those kind of things might have kind of resonated out into a broader culture beyond the festival.
Yeah, definitely. No, it's a great question. I mean, I was thinking, I've talked quite a lot with sort of curators and artists when I was over there, and I mean, there's so many interesting moments where I felt the hands of censorship. So, for example, with the piece that I was talking about in the gallery originally, the artist was meant to be naked, but the gallery was like, no, you know, that can't really happen because we've had an incident here before where there was a lot of kind of trouble and difficulty. And so I think there's this kind of real, like, unspoken tension in a lot of the work that I kind of saw. And I mean, obviously, I kind of had a slightly, I was allowed in and sort of, you know, talk to curators and things like that. But there's definitely sort of a tension around these works where you feel like things could have been almost slightly different, if that makes sense.
Yeah, if I could just, Paul O'Kane.
If I could just follow up on that, I just wondered if you encountered actual hostility to the events, because when I was in Paris last year with the Association of International Critics of Art, there were curators from Istanbul there who talked about kind of gangs turning up at private views and closing them down or smashing windows. It was really it's quite terrifying scenario. Was there any sort of hostility to the...
There was no hostility, but towards the performances that I was kind of looking at and the people I spoke to. But I know that the Zilberman Gallery, where the performance I saw was performed in 2010, Sukran Moral, who is quite a famous Turkish performance artist, she did a work where she was going to have sex with another woman on stage. On stage. Talking about your piece. Were in the gallery and that was closed down, and Morale received death threats through the post. She had to move to Rome for a while. Then she was kind of like pushed out of Rome and went back to Germany. You know, there was all sorts of things that happened. So I think it's a real prescient threat. You know, it's not just something that's sort of being talked about as if it might happen. It is very, very present there. And I think artists are very aware of that and working under those conditions.
I'm quite interested in the... But it's hard, I'm sure it's practically impossible to know, really, but whether these art performances are having a knock-on effect outside of the art world. You know what I mean? Because if they are politically motivated, the artists, and they feel this urgency and they've chosen that way of working because I wonder whether they feel that it's still kind of like last dregs of a go at having a go at the state or the oppression they feel, or if they do feel it actually liberates them, even if it's not necessarily directly effective.
I think it must do, because, I mean, even something like Standing Man, where he was just sort of stood in Gezi Park, in Taksim Square, sort of continuously, I mean, the whole point was it was passive resistance. And I mean, this is sort of, it's not strictly kind of performance art within the gallery, but that clearly really bothered the authorities.
So it got known by people very well.
It was all over. Erdogan was very, very vocal about how much he hated Twitter during everything that was happening. And I think it clearly had an effect, because they were like, well, what do we do? We can't attack him because it's passive resistance. You know, so I think it clearly, the ripple effects are being felt. And I think they're very, yes, they might be tacit, but I think they are present, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, I think what strikes me about the piece... The piece is that although I think it's something we think we know, that that performance takes us to the edge of art or the edge of life. There's something edgy about performance.
We
think we know that, but I think in this current political climate, that's sort of exemplified in some way by the situation in Istanbul. You really communicate in the piece how, when push comes to shove, if I can say that, performance sort of arises as a necessary, an essential mode of expression, stroke, protest.
Yeah. Thanks for putting it that way. It's good. No, it's good. Paul, just because you're talking, and we want to talk about your piece as well, in terms of difference, say, you review a book called, it's by Matilda Roman, called On Stage... Matilde Roman, you say it. On Stage, the Theatrical Dimension of Video Image. And it's primarily about video installation, I think. But in terms of that as a kind of different kind of experience to... For both the artist and the audience, I suppose, I mean, quite nice to kind of move into yours a bit and talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, as you've been sort of sitting here thinking, talking and looking at comparing the pieces that have come together for the show, I have been thinking about the distinction. I suppose the obvious distinction is mediation. It's this technological mediation between live performance and what Matilde's book focuses on is the phenomenon, in a way, the exponential phenomenon and transformation that video and installation and the nexus of video installation have brought to bear on our institutions, our experience of art, our evaluation of those things. So yeah, in comparison with the piece about the Turkish performance event, I was thinking about it the central difference is to do with mediation that Mathilde is talking about. The way that video and installation have come to transform the space, which has changed our behaviour in the space.
The audience's.
The audience's behaviour, the way we move through a space that's perhaps installed with several videos, durational pieces. But if I'm moving through a space like that, like we might think of the tanks at Tate Modern, for example, I might feel inclined to hang out here for a bit, watch this for 2 minutes, get bored with that, or sort of move on to something that I get involved with for a longer period of time. But I think that during that process, what Mathilde points out in the book is that we're becoming increasingly aware of our performance and our passage and our gestures and postures in the spaces in relation to...
So we can become like self-conscious of our reaction.
Absolutely. So we are
deciding how long we feel we can stay or...
Yeah, so that we become on stage, the participants inside a video are in some ways on stage, and the image, as one of the chapters is titled, I've forgotten the title, but images, the idea that the images themselves are on stage is referred to in one of the chapters of the book. So there's a kind of multiple layers,
You talk about mise en abîme.
Yeah,
which I had to look up, but I kind of knew what it was. It's when you get that thing, and actually, funny if it happens in one of the cartoons that I watched that Jamie saw, where basically something is within itself and goes back and back, recessing on and on and on.
Yeah, kind of infinite regression, yes. Of self-reflexivity or something, or of a space, I suppose.
Maybe. Certainly layering. Jamie, did you want to come in?
Can I just ask, I just wondered if one of the sort of central kind of tenets of the book was whether or not this sort of predisposition towards like full immersion of the viewer had led to a kind of... Like a viewer fatigue or something. Is that one of the points that's raised?
I don't think Mathilde uses the word fatigue in the book, but there's a lovely phrase, and I sort of mentioned there's a preface by Mika Bal, and he sort of champions Mathilde's writing style, and I mentioned that in the book as well. She's got this very subtle way of saying a lot with a few words, and she may not use the word fatigue, but there is this kind of strange new sense of our purpose, or questioning our purpose in the space that the video installation has brought us. I mean, sometimes it successfully immerses us, perhaps, and then we come away feeling somehow fulfilled. But quite often there's a sense of uncertainty, and there's this lovely phrase she used of leaving an installation with uncertain steps, because you're not actually sure if you've seen the whole thing, or what you were supposed to see, or whether you're going to return, or what's happening once you've left, etc.
There's the other thing about when you come, you don't know how long it's on for.
Yeah, I think
quite often there's no information, so you don't know if that matters or not.
And I think the important thing is that it's a technological, exponential technological transformation of the art gallery space, and it changes our relationship with the work, our relationship with ourselves, and our relationship with other people that we see wandering around in this, stumbling around in these video installations.
And sometimes there's someone stumbling around in the video.
Well, exactly.
In the work, isn't there?
And
she talks about that, because it's almost like that's what you often see when you see them, which can't be always true at all.
But. It does turn up in a few of the examples. It does turn up in a few of the examples that... we, having wandered looking for something through the video installation, find ourselves watching somebody wandering through a landscape or an architectural space.
It's obviously quite a different experience to watching a performance.
Yeah, well, I was actually just going to jump in there because I was sort of interested about what kind of immersive experiences like that do to the kind of architectures of labour within the gallery or the institution, you know, those who work on exhibitions and installations that kind of are immersive. I'm thinking here about something like Musée de la Danse, which was like a large-scale performance event over a weekend. And Catherine Wood, who's curator of performance at Tate, you know, writes quite interestingly about how performance can really alter, you know, it puts pressures on people like the health and safety departments, the ticketing departments. It puts pressure on the sort of those people that you don't necessarily expect it to. And I'm sort of interested in how these new kind of potentially sort of in inverted commas spectacular experiences inflect upon those people, you know.
It's particularly in large institutions. I mean, if you do it outdoors or you do it spontaneously in a park, like as the guy in Istanbul did, then you're not. Mm. It's different.
Yeah.
It's interesting, actually, the way that staff mobilise in response to those kinds of situations. Mm. I think we've both worked in public arts institutions, and I can think of numerous instances where staff have to collectively petition a curating body in order to have a work either turned down or tempered in some way in order to kind of...
survive the day.
Totally. Yeah, yeah. That there is a dramatic impact on working conditions that I think staff in public-facing roles are just expected to get on with and put up with.
Do you think artists should be thinking about this
totally.
More?
Absolutely.
But I think artists are...
That's interesting.
Yeah, I think artists also are thinking about it. So something like Tino Segal's These Associations, which was on at the Tate in 2012, I was working actually as a ticketing assistant during that time. And I remember sort of people who were just sort of tourists or people going around the Tate coming up to me and saying, like, what is this work? And, you know, the sort of assumption of labour that I think that puts on someone is quite interesting. And I'm pretty sure artists, e.g. Tino Segal, must have thought about that at some point, you know, that we're going to have to, as ticketing assistants, back up his work in a way.
It's an interesting connection back to Mathilde's book. When I remember those crowds of surging people in the Turbine Hall and the idea that the audience is sometimes performing or something like that is a good connection. But in the review, I did try to tentatively connect this Mathilde's kind of thesis with the idea of attention economy, that there's something about the duration or video installation experience which makes new kinds of demands on us in terms of duration and attention. But there was something I thought we sort of skipped over that was maybe important to go back to, which was the fact that... I talked about the distinction between this live event that you covered and Mathilde's book being mostly to do with mediation and technology. But I think what I was trying to work my way towards was the idea that Mathilde's book seems to raise a kind of ontological or philosophical problematic condition of the 21st century subject, whereas your description of this very intimate, very tense and moving, empathetic live experience is an immediately more political or more overtly political. You feel a strong political responsibility for another human body directly in front of you. And surely that's one of the great distinctions that we're making between these two pieces.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's... I mean, I'm always so careful about kind of... And I say in the article about kind of being just next to a person doesn't necessarily mean that that body is, like, knowable as a subject. But I do think there is something kind of just inexplicable about being close to someone, essentially. And I do think whether that's inherently political, I'm not quite sure yet. But I do know what you mean. And I do think there is something different about the live body that is, just... And I think maybe the fact that the body isn't knowable is actually what makes it kind of interesting. You know, it's the fact that that body isn't someone that you know or that you necessarily can connect to automatically.
It's quite interesting that a lot of performance artists take their clothes off.
Yeah.
Following what you said, but they do.
Yeah.
But they really, and they always, often, by the way, have lovely bodies, which is very annoying because they should all be not, they should be more normal, I always feel. Some of them seem to be too nice. Did I say something wrong? I don't mean that I fancy them.
I just love that you're watching performance art and just looking at... Yeah.
No, I would rather they were all fat, ugly old men like me.
I think a lot of them are. If you've seen Vito Acconci's trademarks...
Yes, I know there have been some. How can we bring animation to this, guys? Let's talk about... I'm really interested still in the audience. You think of the audience experience. Mm. The one is walking around in these big institutions within an immersed video installation. One's sitting or standing or whatever, but very intimately with a live performance that's happening, and it could go any way. Mm. and it could even be infiltrated to by the police or something.
Yeah.
And the other one is sitting probably in a cinema seat.
Well, yeah.
Tell me what it was like, Jamie.
This is one of the things. I mean, the event that I wrote about was a series of screenings curated by Herb Schellenberger at Tate Modern in the Star Auditorium. And it was a series of 51 films over the course of 3 days, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
That's a lot of films.
It's an insane amount of films. 45 of them, I think, were either original prints or remastered prints. So
there's quite a hell of a organisation. Yeah, because I watched a few on computer and they were not in the best condition.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's if people read the article, I think it's really worth following up some of the films that I mentioned, which are available through different sites like Ubu and YouTube and Vimeo, but obviously in very degraded quality. But the thing that was nice about this event particularly was just seeing the enthusiasm of a community kind of forming over the course of 3 days and seeing people at each event and having conversations with
people. So that's a bit of a performance, really.
In a way, yeah.
You got to know some new people, did you?
There were a series of exchanges between the curator, Herb, and some of the animators via Skype. So they'd kind of Skyped in from the States.
And you could listen to those conversations?
Yeah, totally. And take part in them. So there was a direct kind of conduit to the creators themselves, many of which have been working in relative obscurity since the 1970s. So to have that kind of access to that dialogue was really fantastic. But basically what the film programme attempted to do was excavate this often overlooked, little known strain of experimental film work that was taking place in the United States throughout the 70s and 80s, mainly focused on independent animation. That's animation taking many different kind of forms. It's a very expanded sense of what animation can be. So there were 5 events. Each one had a different theme, ranging from sort of pop collage works, works that resembled in some senses colour field and kind of abstract works of structural filmmaking. There was a particularly great programme called Body Mania, which focused specifically on metamorphosis and understanding of the body through different kind of metamorphic processes. Introspection was something that seemed to underscore the entire programme, which is something I'll come on to, because it seems really integral to the animator's process. A lot of these practitioners are working frequently in isolation.
Slowly as well.
Very, very slowly, yeah. So it becomes this kind of naturally meditative state that you're working through.
I can't imagine how they do it. I have to say, I mean, I really, you think of it, you don't see the agony.
Yeah.
It must be.
Well, this is one of the most kind of enlightening conversations was with Frank and Caroline Morris, who have worked together, I think, since the mid-70s. Frank Morris was creating films in the late 60s, I think. He made a film called You're Not Real Pretty But You're Mine, 1968, which was in the first screening. And just listening to the two of them talk about the distribution of labour here in relation to how they actually produced the films was quite interesting.
Don't tell me. The man did far more labour. Go on.
But it's, I mean, it was fairly sort of evenly balanced in terms of you know, what each of them was bringing to the table. There was a slightly unusual kind of reliance upon Frank Morris for the kind of clerical capacities of like his partner. So she was the one who was doing the organisational work, which just seemed a little bit predictable. But the work that really came to the fore for me focused really on an exploration of a body's capacity to sort of be sort of sensual. And the films that I've really come away thinking a lot about by Lisa Crafts and Sally Cruikshank and Susan Pitt. I think one of them, Lisa Crafts' Desire Pie, is particularly interesting because it was used as a kind of therapeutic tool. And it looks like a typical sort of 1970s Fritz the Cat sort of erotic animation. But she was working in a milieu where a lot of kind of heterosexual, sex-oriented films were made by men for men, prioritising a male gaze, prioritising a very male form of sensuality, whereas she was interested in manipulating the bodies that she was depicting through these weird cartoons in order to try and reformulate a different understanding of desire and a different understanding of the application of desire. So there are all sorts of weird
Is that drawn animation?
Yeah, totally.
I watched one and that was.
Yeah. I mean, hers is pretty kind of elaborate in terms of its appearance. But yeah, it was just, there's just a little kind of fact that I pulled up here about it, which was that it was actually used by the Multimedia Resource Centre, who used it for work with sex educators and therapists in a bid to kind of relax participants before discussions, sort of therapeutic discussions.
It's a cartoon, we can have a laugh. Anything that's an animated cartoon is funny.
Totally, which I think goes to the kind of the heart of why this stuff is so usable, I think, politically, because there's the kind of peculiar sort of ghettoisation of comic books and cartoons in terms of, you know, it's explicitly the preserve of children, means that it's sort of permissible in some way, that there are different transgressions that can be made in terms of content, which you just won't find in other media.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, in terms of going back to what we were talking about earlier, I mean, this thing of what's effective.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I ever use the right. Is it affective or effective? I never get that right. But you know, politically, which is often what artists are claiming they really want, and it's just that we're artists, we do it this way because we're artists, but we really want to be. Like, and funnily enough, that might be more effective.
Yeah.
Possibly, in a form that you could call conventional or certainly not.
Well, this is one of the things that I really took away from this, and it's something that I've spoken to Herb about since the screening, is that a lot of these animators were working in industry to support themselves. So Frank and Caroline Morris and
Ward Kimball?
Ward Kimball was working with Disney, but I think more interestingly, Frank and Caroline Morris and Sally Cruikshank were working on Sesame Street and Nickelodeon, very early Nickelodeon cartoons, and MTV. I think they kind of, you know, were responsible for creating something of the aesthetic of those platforms.
But then they did something else with that.
Yeah,
took the aesthetic somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, I think they had more license with their own work independently. But the thing that I find really interesting, I mean, Sesame Street is the product of the Carnegie Foundation, which is the kind of Scottish philanthropic drive to implement municipal libraries across the United States. So Sesame Street has this kind of egalitarian access to information principle guiding it. But it also has this amazing kind of crossover with conceptual art. So William Wegman, you know, one of the primary kind of American conceptualists, is the guy responsible for all of the dogs, you know, moving balls across the screen and kind of counting sweets and stuff like that. There's this amazing kind of crossover between fairly radical, I'd say sort of left-wing progressive artistic practice and children's television, which needs to be kind of dredged up and sort of celebrated. So, yeah, that was one of the things that really came out of this for me.
Yeah, well, it's being able to listen to them talking about their work and finding some of that stuff out, presumably, when they were doing that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're all incredibly sort of self-effacing, deferential people, which is incredibly endearing.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
A lot of them are just kind of completely astounded that people are, you know, bothering to look at their films.
Well, I mean, Ward Kimball did one where he was he depicted U.S. President Lyndon B. Johnson with a testicular chin and a phallic nose that grows erect to the patriotic tune of the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Glory, 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 hallelujah. I watched that one with some amusement. I'd say his nose wasn't a noser by the end.
That was a kind of parodic send-up of, I guess, sort of military industrial hubris and specifically the kind of route to war for the United States and to the kind of period of the Vietnamese War. Yeah, I mean, there's a kind of real distinction, and I bring this up in the article, but some of the earlier films handle sort of pop imagery and specifically the image of the female sexualized body in quite sort of dubious ways. And I make this point about this image of like the female sexualized body being both an indication of the superficiality of the era, but also a kind of symbol of regeneration or kind of fertility.
So like a double-edged sword use of that.
But it's really crude. It's just a really crude
thing.
There
was an amazing one I saw where a woman started drinking I don't know, Fanta or something. Then she had a beer, and then she'd suddenly just appear on the screen as a film. And in the end, then she was drinking Domestos or something.
Yeah, that's the... I think it's Fred McGubb.
That was...
Fred McGubb's The Pop Show, is that right?
But she kept smiling. Whatever she drank, she smiled afterwards. I thought that was quite funny, actually.
Yeah, it is. I just think there's like a... There's definitely a kind of violence inherent to that depiction that I just don't think, you know... The maker was necessarily...
Paul, you want to come in? Yeah. You come in.
Yeah, I've just been curious about there's a little section at the end of the review where it talks about the current vanguard of critical cartooning and then talks about Nickelodeon and Paper Rad and I was just kind of curious about the way that this show, which is set in the 70s and 80s, how it really maps onto and links to things like the use of contemporary digital video animation by fine artists or the facilities available in new animation technologies for political responses to our present situation.
But this is one of my kind of primary interests at the moment in terms of this distribution of labour that I mentioned before. And directly in relation to that, there are some very good examples recently where I think animators and people who wouldn't necessarily designate themselves as animators, but they're definitely people who work with the generation of digital imagery, are being outsourced to create work for fine artists. And they don't necessarily speak the same language. They definitely don't speak with the same kind of conceptual terminology, philosophical terminology. But they definitely have a kind of an advanced and progressive understanding of the medium that they work with. And there are two very good examples I can think of. So Clifford Sage, who works with the Studio Workflow, will often make work with Lawrence Leck or Sidsel Monica Hansen. The Sidsel Monica Hansen show at Gasworks I went to and thought was fantastic for numerous reasons, but central to my experience of that show was an understanding of Clifford's aesthetic as something that exists beyond, you know, this very kind of tight domain of fine art.
So there is some sense of continuity, a kind of legacy that's being...
Totally. I mean, there is in a different sense as well, I think formally and conceptually, but I think just in terms of how workload and I think a kind of introspective sort of period of isolation has been outsourced is kind of interesting in this sense. So Adam Sinclair is another independent sort of digital producer who works with Ed Atkins and produces all the kind of glitchy disembodied heads for him, which is something that exists in Adam's own work in a completely different sort of rephrased sense, but has a kind of a value within a kind of conceptual art practice.
Go on, which one do you like better?
Ed Atkins or who?
The one?
Or Adam Sinclair? Yeah. both good in my book.
Fine.
Do you think there's a sort of... Do you find that, like, problematic? Or what do you think of the sort of... I mean, bit, you know, what do you think of the ethics of that? Or is it just a form of kind of strategic kind of collaboration, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's something that has to be negotiated between the artist and the animator.
Yeah. You know?
I think as long as a credit is sort of, you know, in place and there's, you know, adequate remuneration, then I suppose it's something that the animator definitely has agency in those situations. You know, they're able to withdraw from projects.
Do you think it changes what the... I mean, in the way that there's not introspection, there's not... Like, what you see is not the same kind of out of the form in the same way as that... I mean, say you were animating something and it took you ages, you might invent a way of drawing in a particular kind of way that meant it was quicker.
Yeah,
I think if you never make it,
There's definitely a disconnect. I mean, one of the films that was so great in Herb's screening was a series of films by Mary Beams, which are very, very simple line drawings that just kind of unfold across the screen, usually against a kind of coloured background. And there's something about the intimacy that she has with the material. There's actually a really good resource that I would kind of recommend people chase up that Herb put me onto, called Frames, which is a book that the animator George Griffin put together in 1978. And this was the product of a letter that was sent to a series of animators asking them to create a page that sort of exemplified their animation process. And Mary Beams just writes really beautifully on her approach to animation. She says, drawing is touching time. That there's a direct kind of haptic relationship between the application of pencil to paper and the kind of intermediary presence of the camera that allows her to, embrace in a more kind of sensual and engaged manner this kind of chronological, you know, experience. But she gives in this book the example of a whale song being something that's imploring her to kind of communicate, or it's a sort of appeal to her. And one of the ways that she sort of processes that appeal is by drawing the whale's form and then seeing it sort of unfold in time. And there's a kind of a sort of sympathy or a sort of sympathetic process at play there.
I was just wondering, going back to earlier on, we were trying to make comparisons between media, really, you know, between what's happening in video installation, live performance, and I don't think we've quite sort of bolted the animation onto that.
Go on, you do it.
Well, it's just that in the introductory paragraph, Jamie talks about, I think animation as something that produces an extraordinary sense of possibility, in a way. Mm. The magical possibility for
the openness of it.
Well, a can can turn into a worm, turn into a butterfly, a world will burst out of a Coke can. There's something, refer to that as sort of essential and peculiar to animation, which I think everyone knows what you mean when you say that. They've seen Disney's Fantasia, or they've seen various 50s advertisements, et cetera. So I was just wondering about the, in a way, I'm wondering about the philosophical and political implications of that. What's the
in terms of that sense of limitlessness?
Yeah, I mean, earlier on we were trying to sort of talk, I was sort of trying to say that you know, maybe the video installations that Mathilde writes about in her book bring us into contact with a slightly uncomfortable sense of the 21st century subject, somebody who's kind of lost and wandering and on stage. Maybe they're not really living anymore. They're performing, this kind of Butlerian interpretation of 21st century subject. The live performance seems to bring us back to some kind of inescapable physical empathetic reality and society. And I was just trying to work out where this, if we could draw the infinite becomings of animation that I referred to in your first paragraph into that dialogue to talk about how it serves a 21st century subject or something.
Yeah, I mean, the sort of line that I would take into that would be my closing paragraph references a body of text that the theorist Rosie Brodotti wrote for an exhibition that I think Oliver Larrick put on a few years ago. And I saw Oliver Larrick do this really kind of lackluster presentation at the ICA as part of the Artist Film Club, where he just showed a series of animations which do exactly what you were talking about. They show the transformation of a human body into a kind of inert consumer object. And there's the kind of consolidation of desire there in some way. And I think the thing that really struck me was that he wasn't able to articulate why he was interested in this stuff. It was just this total kind of fascination, but without any kind of conceptual kind of armature to kind of lay it on. And I think from my perspective, there's a sort of generational predisposition towards animation because of this limitlessness, but for multiple reasons. I think one of them is a sense of porosity, that through sort of seeing this work and being kind of sensitized to it, there's a different sense of how my body is kind of enmeshed with the world. It isn't a hermetic sort of finite kind of standalone subject. There's a different sense of interconnectedness. And I think that's like a very kind of elementary reading, but I think it's really important. And I think it's something that kids, you know, sort of fundamentally understand about this stuff, and that kind of carries through.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking, when you're walking around the installations of video, you're manipulated. You are manipulated in the way that, and I mean, I know it's not the same thing, but the manipulation is moved from within the work, say the animation, to the person who's experiencing it more, because you are completely absorbed and surrounded by all this technology, and as you say, the 20th century kind of coming at you from all sides.
Yeah. I mean, Brian's description of the body is rather inescapable. It's something
that one stone. It's all sort of very, very particular, very singular, concentrated moments.
Yeah,
which is very different to the idea of sound coming at you from all different places and speakers and images. And
but I think it's important as well. I think that stone is a reminder of the kind of fact that that kind of transcorporeal experience that you're talking about, Jamie, isn't just necessarily between bodies. It's kind of between bodies and objects too. And I think that stone was a reminder that we're kind of not only negotiating.
Do you think the audience know what we mean by the stone?
Oh yeah,
well,
sorry.
You could describe the port slightly more. I mean, yeah. we did sort of say it. Yeah.
The stone, the monolithic stone.
Yeah, sorry,
stone.
I'm talking about the performance which you watched, yeah. Where the guy did it for 48 hours,
yeah,
and dropped it. No, it's not,
yeah.
You saying. He dropped the stone, didn't
he? Yeah, so he was sort of, throughout this 48 hours, he had this like particular stone, very smooth, beautiful object that he kind of carried with him. I think it became sort of quite meditative, the way he held it and the way, like very sensitive, the way he began touching it, and actually quite sensual in a way. But there were moments in which, like, you know, he might fall asleep and it just dropped and crashed onto the floor.
Oh, I see.
And then there was a moment where, which I found just strangely, and I write about this in the article, kind of strangely kind of affecting, where a woman picked it up and gave it back to him. And it was this very simple act. But yeah, going back to kind of what you were saying, Jamie and Paul, about, I think it's important to remember that we can have these kind of heightened experiences with objects. I think we kind of...
But you related that to politics as well.
Yeah.
That gesture. Can
yeah.
you say more about that?
Well, I think it's really important that the vulnerability of that moment and kind of the fact that, you know, when these political moments of duress are happening and they're forcing bodies to be vulnerable and they're making bodies vulnerable, that there's a kind of... sort of they're creating their own vulnerability, which they are in charge of or in control of in a way.
And you seem to suggest that in a phrase you used twice, a time of political uncertainty,
yeah.
when we don't know how to respond, that
yeah.
there's something in these tiny acts that's perhaps the most important of all, or when we can't take on the huge monsters that are facing us today, maybe it's in these tiny gestures that we find some hope or something.
Yeah, I think it's also about choice. I mean, I don't really, I guess kind of maybe agency as well slightly, but, and I mean, that sort of seems negligible in comparison to what is happening to so many people, but I think having that sense of choice of being able just to hold, choosing how to hold your body and do a certain thing in a certain moment is quite important actually. And it's sort of unspoken, but I think just the freedom... And yeah, the freedom of the body to kind of move, which some people don't sort of necessarily always have access to, is quite important. And I found quite kind of provocative, really.
Mm. Yeah, I imagine that was all in your mind in a way. No. I mean, literally, you're aware of where you are when you're at that performance.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
It's there with you, really.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and also, it's a sort of I never know what really symbolic, metaphorical thing. Mm. Which stands for what a lot of whatever you want to bring to it, really.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Maybe that's also worth emphasising as well, that the piece that Jamie saw was a curation of 70s and 80s films. Mathilde's book is a kind of reflection on a generation of video installation art. But what Bryony is looking at is a direct and absolute response to the political situation in Istanbul now, and that's the art that came out of it. And that's quite a strong distinction, I think.
And I think also I think what was really important about that moment in Istanbul was that, like, you know, what's happening there at the moment is a kind of a forcible rupturing of bodies. It's trying to disconnect people, it's trying to kind of drag people apart, force difference between people, and I think moments where that difference is not, you know, sometimes elided across, maybe kind of quite simplistically only for 5 minutes, like maybe there is actually just some kind of importance in that, in those moments.
I just, one question I just wanted to raise in relation to that was just how artists are sort of negotiating visibility and invisibility, and how sort of subterfuge might work in terms of the kind of potency of performance. And one of the things that I was thinking about when I read your piece was the work of Yuri Kavanda, who was working in Czechoslovakia under kind of communist rule.
Yeah.
And ephemerality had a, you know, huge kind of importance for him strategically in terms of the kind of untraceability of his events. And I just wondered if there was anything, because you're kind of working with a platform that is, you know, announcing itself and is making a very kind of pronounced gesture. I just wondered whether or not within that framework there was a sense of how things were being negotiated.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting about the idea of ephemerality or the idea of documentation as a kind of privilege in a way. Mm. And the fact that, like, many artists work who are working in performance kind of work towards documentation as kind of these traceable remains. But actually, for many people, the fact that kind of performance is ephemeral in some respects is kind of an advantage, because it means that it doesn't necessarily, they might not have to take on the responsibility that performance kind of engenders. But I think in terms of how artists are sort of working practically, the artists I met when I was in Istanbul, I mean, I think they're very conscious of documenting their work now, especially with kind of the advent of certain technologies that allow that to happen in a kind of more generative way, because it means that their work is just vaguely more sellable. And I think there is just something quite practical about artists working towards ensuring that they're, like, paying the bills. And I think for Perform Istanbul, that's something that they're very aware of, is ensuring that they can, these artists are taking home money at the end of the day, which is actually quite sort of new and radical when you talk to some performance artists.
So they do record, when you're at these performances, there is a camera on a tripod, or there are certainly people allowed to do it with their phones. Because I was actually thinking you might say, no, they don't do that at all, because they don't want it to be recorded, because they don't want it to be, I don't know, it's like a kind of moment that happens, but it mustn't be findable. Or, I mean, I'm not saying they're secretive, necessarily need to be secretive, but it does change it, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Recording it, it's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, with this performance particularly, I think it wasn't, you know, it didn't do anything like that was going to annoy anyone massively. Like, he wasn't naked, he didn't do anything to his body, he didn't kind of brand himself or scar himself or any of those things that are so heavily associated with performance art. But what was interesting is that obviously it was going on for 48 hours, so how you document that is kind of crazy. But what they did is they set up a tripod and it documented the first 15 minutes of every single hour. So I find that kind of, like, perspective of documentation, the kind of tangential nature of it, very interesting about, you know, what you choose to kind of create for this kind of record, and the way in which the curator was kind of negotiating that was very present in the room, and, you know, making those choices seemed to be, everybody was very conscious of it, the artist, curator, everyone involved.
Yeah, because, I mean, there are people who only do video performance.
Yeah.
And again, it's like reversing the whole thing in a way, which is quite.
Yeah, I mean, I was just, I was just going to throw the question back to Jamie in a way, that the idea of the sort of subversive element, and it was going back to my previous question to you. I think I was just sort of trying to tease out the contemporary or the current. Potential for the legacy of animation to play a subversive part in social networks, for example, you know, when something can go viral because it's a very short animated image.
The obvious and horrific example to give is the meme team, you know, coined by like Milo Yiannopoulos as an emergent part of the alt-right movement. I think, you know, 4chan as a kind of political, are we about to 5 minutes?
Keep going.
4chan as a sort of political body is, you know, rooted in a fascination with cartoons. You know, anime is like a central component of this online identity and forms the crux of an emergent political network. You know, Japanese kind of cheaply produced cartoon programs. So in terms of the political capacities of animation, I think it's definitely kind of fallen on the wrong side.
But
you know, it's but actually, something that kind of relates to this that I wanted to come back to, actually, just in terms of the theatrical dimension of video image, relates specifically to the case of the He Will Not Divide Us project with Shia LaBeouf, which, you know, unwittingly documented not only the enunciation of the term He Will Not Divide Us by anti-Trump demonstrators, but also this incredibly crass demonstration of, you know, dubious politics to the world, which has now taken equal platform. It just seems like these kind of sort of liminal, not quite art gestures are sort of, I guess, capable of achieving a different sort of potency and different kind of distribution.
Well, guys, you've done brilliantly talking about three different things. I thought they had nothing to do with each other at all when I first saw them all, but now they've all got lots to do with each other. It's really good. So thank you very much indeed for coming on the show. You've been listening to Art Monthly's talk show on Resonance 104.4 FM with Paul O'Kane. I'm probably going to get this wrong now. I know I will. I can feel it. Jamie Sutcliffe and letter from Istanbul, Bryony White, who came on for the first time and did very well. Well
thank
done, Bryony.
You.
Thank and you. Our lovely engineer, Ed.
Thank
he's
you.
Fiddling with all the knobs, and we're going to sign out soon. Thanks for listening again. And this will be on podcast. You may be listening to it on podcast. It's currently streaming out from the studio live and will be again played, I think, at 9 o'clock in the morning in the same way, streamed again. And you can subscribe to Art Monthly for as little as £36 on our website, www.artmonthly.co.uk. Goodbye.